Hello, I'm your host, Grayson Brulte. Welcome to another episode of SAE Tomorrow Today, a show about emerging technology and trends in mobility with leaders and innovators to make it all happen. On today's episode, we're absolutely honored to be joined by Brian Jutko, CEO, Wisk Aero. On today's episode, we discuss the development of Wisk eVTOL aircraft and the FAA certification process. We hope you enjoy this episode. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. Point blank, the future flight's autonomous. Wisk is building that future. Why autonomous? Why now?
Well, why autonomous is really about safety and scalability. So the kinds of aircraft services that we're trying to build, we really intend to bring safe everyday flight to everyone, and that means operating at scale. And we think that the best way to operate at scale is to do so autonomously. And we think the best way to bring safety in that scalability is to do so autonomously. And so that's why we're pursuing it.
That's a really interesting approach. You're right, because the safety and scalability go hand in hand. As you build out the autonomous operations, how are you going to build that trust with the public?
Well, I think trust comes from demonstrating through everyday operations that the service is safe. I don't think that trust comes from telling people that you're going to do something safe. I think in this industry, you have to show that you're actually every day operating in a safe way. And so that's our mission. That's our responsibility. You know, it starts with engineering design. So we focus a lot on that right now. Safety really ends up getting designed into the system in the earliest days of the program. It goes into how we operate our factories now that we've started to build our airplane, keeping our own people safe while we're building the airplane. And then, you know, safety extends into our operations when we start to deliver the service to people.
The show and tell's a great example. I had dinner with a fighter pilot in the military, in the Air Force, came to the Air Force Academy, and we had a long conversation around autonomy and autonomous flight. And this gentleman got to a point where he said, okay, that's classified, but yes, a lot of the stuff we do up there is autonomous and you wouldn't even know it. And he said there's such a level of trust that these highly trained pilots have with autonomy. And he said, frankly, I actually prefer it on flying on autonomous flight. So you mentioned the benefits of autonomous flight are safety and scalability. Are there other benefits that come along with that? Are there sustainability benefits? Are there economic benefits as you're embarking on that?
Well, I think what you're getting at there is, you know, the history of aviation, the history of many systems actually, is humans becoming augmented by automation. And a really important thing to understand about autonomy and robotics in general is that people don't go away in autonomous systems. They change what they're doing. And so obviously the example that you're giving there relates to someone who's experiencing or using increased automation in their job so that they can focus on higher level tasks. Similar for us, we have a responsible person. They just happen to be sitting on the ground supervising the aircraft. And in doing so, they take on a different role. They still exist in the system. And in fact, that human-machine interface is still absolutely critical to the safe operations of the system. And so we have to think about what is that interface? What are the human factors of that interface? So so that's sort of the general principle is humans don't go away. They change what they're doing. And the interface between the automation and the person is a critical design factor for us to consider. Now, you know, what are the other benefits? Well, when you unconstrain an aircraft or any robotic system from having to be in the same place and time as an operator, it means that that aircraft or that asset can become much more flexible. You could deliver a much more flexible transportation network. So you could move these aircraft around in a way that is very difficult to do if you're trying to match airworthy aircrew with airworthy aircraft with, you know, cargo or people all at the same place in the same time. So that kind of network flexibility, in my mind, is actually one of the principal things that starts to enable scalability.
The human supervision side, you're increasing their quality of life. And you're giving them the ability where perhaps they're not stuck at one location as a pilot is typically sometimes. They're able to go in there and operate it from a thing and they can go home at night. Are you seeing individuals that are interested in those types of jobs because you can actually go home at night? It's like, okay, mom or dad has to go to Atlanta today or has to go to Vegas today. It's the planes, so your eVTOLs can go wherever they want, but that individual supervising is just in location A. Is that opening those doors to individuals that are interested in those type of jobs?
Last year, we went to Oshkosh, and we flew our Gen 5 airplane at Oshkosh. And we, if you know Oshkosh, you know there's hundreds of thousands of people that go to Oshkosh. And one of the primary feedbacks that we got from the pilot community, I'm a pilot myself, and so I love that community, was exactly what you're talking about. This is a very interesting concept. You know, this is the kind of feedback we're getting, is this is a very interesting concept because I can operate aircraft, but I can blend it with a life that's a little more, you know, I can go home at the end of the day. The other thing that we heard was that actually these kinds of, this sort of supervisory role could be more available to folks who may have requirements that prevent them from becoming pilots in the first place due to the physical nature of it. And so the accessibility of those kinds of jobs, like those are the feedback that we're starting to get, is that this is actually quite an interesting role, and a role that doesn't exist right now that helps to create new jobs in this kind of a market. And it's coming with features that don't exist for the normal pilot community, and that's attractive in some ways.
I'm going to geek out with you here in a moment, because I'm going to go down the rabbit hole playing a lot with VR and AR headsets. You know, a lot of these kids growing up today, they're growing up immersed in this technology. They're A lot of younger kids are very big into gaming, and they're understanding the physical world. I have a friend, a pilot, went to Oshkosh, and he sent me this photo from last year. He said, yep, I got my landing slot, and it was incredible, the amount there. And so he's an engineer, so he bought a Vision Pro and started building his own version of flight simulator so he can train his pilot, because he's working on getting, I don't know the classifications, but he's trying to upgrade to a Honda jet. That's where he's working his way up to now. Right now he's just flying a Cessna. Is that immersion of these younger children immersed in this technology, growing up with Microsoft Flight Simulator, does that help accelerate the skills that they're going to need to go into that potential job?
Well, I think yes and no. And so the answer is a little bit nuanced. I think on the no, I'll start with the no front. On the no front, we the concept of operations for the aircraft and how the supervisor role is what functions are delegated to that role. They do not fly the airplane in the way that you might be thinking with a Vision Pro. You know, they do not have a joystick, and they don't have a camera that's sort of seeing what a pilot would normally see. They're really supervising multiple vehicles flying what are largely autonomous flights. They have a role that's very similar to, think like an air traffic controller. They have a limited amount of kind of control that they could put into the aircraft to actually fly it. So the lowest, what we call the lowest level of reversionary control, so think, you know, in the event that they do have to intervene in a flight, is providing a vector or an altitude, because that's what you need to do today to be able to fit into the airspace. So you have to be able to take a vector from an air traffic controller as an example. But outside of that, you're largely mission managing. And the reason there is that if we were relying on a person on the ground viewing in the same way that an onboard person was viewing the sort of external scenery in the way that you would imagine with a Vision Pro, we would have to push that information over a command and control link. And that command and control link is not reliable enough to be able to deliver the level of safety that we're intending to deliver in the service. So you have to start with the premise that the C2 link is not a safety critical link. Once the aircraft takes off, and you have to assume, as an example, or we assume, that the C2 link could go away as soon as the aircraft takes off, and it needs to be able to make safe choices at all times. So that's sort of a principal foundational element of how we design the system. So that's kind of the no side. Now on the yes side, it's a little bit more of kind of a nuanced answer is look, I think we're in the middle of incredible technology revolutions, and people are growing up with different expectations from machines, from automation, from all kinds of things. And I think that, you know, in over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, the expectations of people that are growing up now are just going to be different. And they're going to have a level of trust in systems that gets developed over time, and a level of expectation of what automation can provide in their lives. And we're just at the start of that wave.
You're right. children that are growing up today are exposed to different technologies, different ways of thinking. It's just incredible, the technology. And you could have a child that's born in 2024, that your aircrafts are operating at some point in the future. Oh, no problem. This is normal. And it just becomes part of that because that's the technology world they grew up on. I'm curious on the C2 link from a safety perspective. I like your approach. Is that because of latency? Is that why it's not controlled, because of the potential latency issues that come along with that?
It's a holistic conversation when you start talking about command and control links. There's latency, of course, is very important. Integrity and availability are probably more important. And in fact, integrity the most so. You would assume that the availability is actually the most important thing. In other words, do I have this or do I not have it? That's kind of the intuition, is that that's very important. And it is important, but integrity almost more so, because you really need any message that goes to the airplane to be truthful, is kind of the way to think about it, and uncorrupted and so on. And so that sort of is the highest bar, is the integrity of C2 links, availability certainly, and latency, different methods of getting C2 to the airplane, whether it's ground-based or satellite-based, will have different latency. That can be solved with engineering. It's hard problems, but those are all solvable.
I like integrity because point blank, you're increasing security. We won't necessarily get into that, but you're increasing security from your approach around integrity. When is WISS expecting to transport your first commercial passengers?
This decade. So we're in the middle of building the airplane, what we call Gen 6. We're in the middle of building Gen 6 right now. We intend, assuming all goes well in our development program, to fly it by the end of this year. And we're in the middle of an FAA certification program right now, where we're advancing both the type certification of that aircraft system, the operational approvals for the kind of novel aspects of flying an autonomous airplane, and then ultimately, what are the qualifications for a supervisor that will oversee the airplane. So assuming things stay on track and we do well this year, we'll be flying by the end of the year. And we have a number of years in front of us in terms of then getting through the later stages in the certification program.
We'd be flying in the greater Houston region. Is that where you'll start testing operations?
The answer to that is yes. So we recently announced that we're doing some kind of what I think is pioneering work in the Houston area. We have test sites that are outside of Houston, that are here in California, where I'm sitting by our headquarters. So initial flights will be flying in our test sites here, but we will be flying in Houston. The thing that's really interesting about autonomous aircraft and why go to a place like Houston is that we need a place to start to pull all of the non-airplane pieces together. And autonomy is, especially in aviation, it's very tempting to get attracted to the airplane itself, but maybe a majority of the challenge is actually the things that are around the airplane. And so it's critical that we design the airplane system so that it takes into account all the things that are around the airplane, but also that we continue to advance those elements that are around the airplane via test. And so we recently announced that we'll be going to Houston. And what we're doing there is stitching together both the sort of the community aspects of this, the airport sides of this, the airspace sides of this, all the things we just talked about on C2 links, all the kind of ground-based operations, and really just holistically stitching together all of the non-airplane aspects of this program.
Houston has it's a United hub of the George H.W. Bush airport there. Will you operate at an airport? And if so, is that where that individual supervisor comes for the air traffic control aspect, just because the amount of planes that are going in and out of George Bush Airport?
We will operate in an airport. So we announced Sugarland Airport is one of the places that we're starting here. And the rationale there is, the rationale is somewhat obvious. It's that starting in a place that already contends with airplanes is very valuable. And so I personally think that airport where one end of the trip is going to be starting or terminating at an airport, will be the places where these kind of flights start. And so Sugarland is a very good opportunity for that. Now, everywhere we are, not just in Houston, near some of the major airports or in any other community, we always have to legally and operationally fit into today's airspace. And so that means engaging with air traffic control. It means traffic deconfliction. It means a whole number of things. And so that's part of the sort of critical aspects of the system design that we're going to be testing out there.
When you operate at an airport, you mentioned Sugarland. Does your team or your partners, do you have to upgrade any of the infrastructure, or can you use the pre-existing infrastructure that's already in place?
Largely the pre-existing infrastructure, which is what makes the existing airport infrastructure so interesting, because it's, these are already secure areas that contend with airport operations. Now, we may have some minimal footprint of our own related to the aircraft and some of the systems, but largely we can operate off of an apron or some other controlled area.
When you begin to commercialize operations, does anything have to change from a regulatory standpoint where you can charge a passenger for a paid ride?
Well, things need to change from a regulatory standpoint. So the key thing to understand on this question is that I like to think about this as kind of three legs in a stool. One is we need to certify the airplane. And the FAA has set out a process for certifying novel aircraft of this type. It's called 2117B. And we're working our way through that process now. Now, what we additionally need to contend with are the operational approvals to fly the aircraft. It is possible, as an example, to achieve type certification of the aircraft, but not have the operational approvals to fly the aircraft. And so what we also need to do is advance the waivers and exemptions for flying an uncrewed aircraft in today's airspace. And we're pursuing that in our narrow application. I like to think of it as a gondola, and you take the wire away, basically. And so it's trying to narrow the scope of what we need to contend with operationally so that those waivers and exemptions can be pursued in a safe way. Someday one could imagine rulemaking that's associated with such a thing. And I think, the US will get there, because I believe that this country will ultimately lead on safe integration of autonomous systems. But the first place to start is really with waivers and exemptions on that front. So those are really the kinds of things that are kind of front and center for establishing a service like this. As it relates to charging passengers, once you have a type certified airworthy airplane and you have the operational approvals to fly it, there are existing methods for how passenger booking and all those other things go about.
America will lead on autonomy. It's the same thing on the ground vehicles side. We're hopefully see some movement in Congress with some waivers and exemptions, because autonomy is good for the U.S. economy. We've had several individuals on from the aerospace sector that have gone through FAA certifications. We even had an individual on the podcast that worked for the FAA on certifications. I'd love to get your opinion. What is it like going through the 2117B certification? Obviously, it's very hard. It's very time intensive, but could you share your thoughts on what it's like going through that process, please?
Yeah, I actually think it's a pioneering process. And what I mean by that is it opens a conversation that's really performance-based and not prescriptive. And I think that's valuable. This is probably getting into the weeds a little bit on kind of regulatory approaches, but one of the challenges of a prescriptive approach, if you have a regulation that, rather than saying, just as an example, the aircraft should stop on the runway before it hits something. If instead it says you should have a brake caliper that's X many millimeters thick, and it should have a clamping force of Y many newtons, and it should, and so on and so forth. You could imagine how that would be written. Well, it doesn't leave a lot of room for innovation. That second prescriptive regulation doesn't leave room for how to stop better on the runway. And so what I think is unique about the 2117B process and kind of how the FAA is approaching novel applicants like us is that these are really performance-based conversations that are all about How do we meet and exceed an equivalent level of safety from today's operating system, air transportation system, with very novel approaches and technologies and so on? And so that I think is kind of the really innovative aspect of what's going on right now, is the performance-based nature of it. Now, you know, there's another side to that coin, which is when you're paving a new path, you're paving a new path. And so that's challenging. You know, there's we're collectively, not just, you know, WISC and the FAA, but just as a society, we're kind of, we're driving and we have headlights and they can only see so far. And so, you know, that causes risk, uncertainty, all sorts of things. The way through that is to have transparency and an open relationship between the applicants and the FAA. And, I have deep, deep respect for the FAA and for the way that they've been approaching this. And we have a good relationship. And so I just, my only position on the whole thing is that I think the performance-based mindset is a real enabler. And I think it'll be great if we could all stay there.
I agree with that. What role does design play when you're going through the FAA certification? Is the FAA looking at the design of the aircraft, the redundancies, and various other aspects of the design?
Well, the FAA looks at everything. And in a good way, you know, the validation role, you know, the role that the FAA plays in validating not just the design, because one would think, okay, you know, what's being checked here is the suitability of the design. It actually starts with the suitability of the process. So, you know, the first thing that gets checked is, are you using a process that can ultimately create a design that can, once created, can be used to show compliance to the FAA, for which the FAA then can find compliance. And so it's very holistic. You know, if you haven't been through this before, it's not like an engineering exam where you show, you know, you have a couple of questions and you write down the answer and you show up with the answer. You write the question together and then you do the design and you know, you're observed doing the design, and then you show up and you show your answer and they find compliance to the question. Hopefully that's a useful analogy, but it is extremely holistic.
It's good because what the FAA is doing, they're keeping the sky safe, and that helps build trust and acceptance of the aircrafts. If we go way back in history, if it wasn't for Charles Lindbergh and the Spirit of St. Louis tour, I don't believe we would be here, because Mr. Lindbergh went around city to city to build trust with flying in an aircraft. And Mr. Lindbergh's, the Spirit of St. Louis aircraft, has a lot different design than the WISC aircraft for a variety of engineering reasons and just evolution reasons. Are there strategic advantages to the design of the WISC aircraft as you're developing a new class of aircraft, which is commonly referred to as eVTOLs?
I'll come back to that, but also I want to say, yes, actually, your comment on the FAA is true. You know, the FAA, the U.S. has the safest air transportation system in the world. It's one of the things that draws me to this industry is that it's so exceptional. The amount of people that fly around every day in a tube in the sky that's going, you know, 500 miles per hour and at 35,000 feet and with a safety record that's, you know, that's orders of magnitude safer than what I just did driving to work this morning. It's remarkable. It's almost unbelievable. So that concept is what draws me to this industry. I think that's amazing, and I know I and a lot of people here want to contribute to it. So the WISC airplane, what attributes about it make it safe or suitable for this mission? We have thought a lot about how to deliver redundancy in both the physical systems and in the non-physical systems, so think software that's, you know, that's running on avionics, in really creative ways that make it suitable for being the first autonomous passenger carrying aircraft. So the first aircraft through the gate that can make the claim, which we hope to be validated, that that this aircraft has a level of safety that's similar to what you would experience on today's commercial airplanes. And to do that requires just tremendous amounts of system safety analysis, of thinking about the redundancy and all the in the powertrain redundancy in the avionics and the software, and how the aircraft, not just the physical aircraft itself, but like I was saying, the aircraft and the associated systems around it all interact with one another.
How has the design of the aircraft changed over the lifetime of WISC? Has there been any major structural changes, or has it been little nips and tucks or tweaks here and there?
No, there have been major changes. I mean, you know, the company was really started under a sort of litany of names, but started in around 2010 by Larry Page and a group of pioneers, really, many of whom, some of whom are still at WISC, and many of whom are now all around the industry. And that group of folks got together and with the question of basically, is this possible? Is electric VTOL flight of this type possible? And the concept there was really, can you fit inside a parking space? You know, if you go back and look at the generations 1, 2, and then 3 of the airplanes, you'll notice that it doesn't really have a wing. It's kind of an aircraft that's designed to fit into a very small space. Over time, as the understanding of the systems, you know, that team achieved many firsts in this industry. You know, some of the first, you know, electric VTOL flight of this type, transitioning from vertical flight through horizontal flight, both piloted and autonomous. So incredible pioneering work has been done by this team. Now, over the time, the aircraft configuration has evolved dramatically as the learning of that team progressed. And so the principal aspect has been that, you know, the aircraft grew a wing. The wing is, it turns out, you know, wings are great thrust multipliers that deliver incredible efficiency on the mission. And really, Gen 6 took all the prior technology learnings and really made it suitable for passenger, for certified passenger use. So the wing is now, it's a high wing. The powertrain configuration delivers great noise performance and actual mission performance. And we put a lot of thought into what is the passenger experience. You know, what's the, a lot like the autonomous driving world, you can't just put someone in a car and have it drive around and have them feel like this is a comfortable and enjoyable experience. You have to think about what are they interacting with? What are the screens? What are they being told? How are they being told it? Is it visual? Is it audible? How are you making them aware of the next steps in the journey? And so all of those things needed to be imparted into a configuration that is incredibly reliable and safe, but also enjoyable for passenger experience. That's what Gen 6 is.
And so it's a comfortable experience. Passenger gets in there. Oh, this is refreshing. This is beautifully designed. This is warm and inviting. Is that where that is?
Yeah. And that's, in fact, we've had now hundreds of people come through our design studio. We have a design studio that looks a lot like what you would see in a, you know, in an automotive manufacturer. And so we've brought hundreds of people through, and the primary reaction is what you just described. It's warm, it's inviting. People always ask why the color yellow. They say, is that because you want to be like a taxi? No, it's because the color yellow is very friendly. You know, we're not intending to make something that's dark and inspired by autonomous aircraft of the past or current, which are used in military applications. Like we're intending to create a friendly, welcoming experience.
You don't want a stealth black one.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, yeah. Pointy shapes and hanging things under the wing is probably not suitable for the mission.
No, it's not good. No, I'm not going on that. Oh, yellow. Oh, that's inviting. Oh, okay. I saw that at my kid's school. Oh, okay. In we go. You're developing a passenger experience. That's going to be one side. Could be a very big side of your business. And then I'm curious, delivery. Will you eventually do a delivery-only version of the WISC aircraft, or will you modify the interior? What are your thoughts on delivery?
We have thought deeply about that question, and we've made an aircraft that, like many aircraft, is suitable for dual use. And so, you know, we're really pursuing, as I mentioned, the passenger-carrying autonomous application. But of course, we've thought deeply about what are the cargo type of requirements, and we've put those into the aircraft. Now, you know, a lot of folks at this point, we'll ask a question that's kind of similar to, isn't it easier to start with cargo carrying aircraft first? And what we've discovered, or at least have some conviction about, is that the safety bar between a cargo carrying aircraft of this type and scale and a passenger carrying aircraft of this type and scale is the same. So we would want to meet, and I think we would be demanded to meet by regulators, the exact same safety bar. We would at least impose that on ourselves. And so the typically where this question goes is can't you lower the safety bar? It's not always asked like this, but it's if you read between the lines, you know, can't you lower the safety bar by pursuing a cargo application first? And at least us answering that question for ourselves is no. We would impose the exact same safety bar as a passenger carrying aircraft. And so for that reason, we're focused on what we think is the right mission, which is passengers, but we also have the ability to carry cargo if someday we choose to do that.
I agree with you. Passenger is the right one. There's a better business case from an economic standpoint. But if you did move cargo, I'm thinking about this, give you a suggestion here. You move luggage between JFK and LaGuardia, two airports that are close together where individuals are going from one airport to the other. You can, no pun intended, you can run a luggage taxi service back and forth to move the luggage. That's an idea if you ever did go into delivery. That's a airport to airport, short distance. But I like your approach there on passenger. From an industry-wide perspective, you're part of the eVTOL industry. How is the industry collectively preparing for the introduction and adoption of eVTOLs? Is it an industry-wide movement? How is everybody working together to do this?
Well, I think, there's been tremendous progress. You know, if you look at, a company who I deeply respect, Joby, who's just been really pioneering in this space for some time, they have a piloted aircraft, of course, but they're well down the certification pathway right now. And in fact, recently had their certification basis as part of the 2117B process published in the Federal Register. And so that as sort of an indicator of industry readiness, that says to me, you know, very capable team, very capable company capability, for lack of a better word, and a regulatory process that's moving along. And so, you know, I think what you're going to see here soon is the start of initial operations of these kinds of aircraft. And, you know, they'll be piloted. And I think it's going to be amazing because at a minimum, I think that these aircraft will be safer than the aircraft that they're replacing. And they don't have any source emissions. So I think that's good for the world if we start replacing vertical aircraft with aircraft that are battery powered and that have lower noise and higher levels of safety. I think it's sort of rare that a technology comes by and is able to influence such significant dimensions in that kind of a way. And so anyway, so I think those are early indicators of success. And, you know, I root really hard for companies like Joby to achieve the mission. I think there's a couple of companies in Europe as well who are making good progress. You know, I know Volocopter is trying to fly at the Olympics this year. I don't know about, you know, if they'll achieve that or not, but I think if they do, it'll just be an incredible moment for the industry at large, because on a global stage, folks will start to see the benefits of these kinds of airplanes.
I've actually met the Volocopter CEO and had dinner with him. And I agree with you from a global stage perspective. Anybody that's been to the De Gaulle Airport trying to get to downtown Paris, the traffic is horrendous. That's the nicest word I can use. It's very bad. It's very congested. So you could take any form of an eVTOL from the Chicago airport to downtown. That's a game changer. But you highlighted to me the most important aspect of all this: noise pollution. When your aircraft and your peers in the, you eliminate that noise pollution, that enhances the community. Not only are you making the environment cleaner from a sustainability point, you're making the life better on the ground for the individuals that live there. Do you think about noise a lot as you're developing the WISC aircraft and keeping the noise low because the positive benefits it's going to have on the ground of the individuals that you're flying over?
Yeah, I think noise is one of the principal design attributes for an airplane like this. these aircraft simply need to have the right to operate in communities, and the right to operate comes from delivering a value proposition and being safe and all the other things that we talked about, but it also comes from not being a nuisance. And I think, you know, a lot of the limitation of the small aircraft market over the years has come from being a nuisance. And like I said, I'm a pilot myself. And I understand, though, when communities say, I don't want leaded avgas being burned in my community. I don't want airplane noise around my community. I understand that. And so any technologies that come along that start to improve that, I think we should be embracing them and ferociously trying to develop them. So, you know, if you've ever heard one of these aircraft fly, it's really a remarkable experience. You know, it's the kind of thing where you could show data, but it's really the sort of thing that needs to be experienced, because noise is such a complicated subject. You know, the frequency of the noise really matters a lot. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you're familiar with a helicopter, the typical kind of wop wop sound of the blade spinning around, versus what, you know, these kind of airplanes have a very kind of low kind of rumble almost, which is very different frequency. So even if you're at the same decibel level, which we're not, it sounds very different. You know, the layperson way to think about this is, you could hear these airplanes when they're taking off and landing, depending on how close you are. But when they're flying overhead, they're imperceptible. And that's kind of amazing to me that, you know, we can create an airplane that can fly at a pretty low level and you could not hear it if it was flying directly over your head.
That's special. There's no way to describe it. I live in a restricted airspace, so I never hear aircraft, but I have friends that live in non-restricted airspace and the noise pollution. I'm like, why did you buy this house? It's really dramatic. And what you're going to do, as I said again, is special from a noise perspective. In your opinion, what is the future of WISC?
The future of WISC? Well, the future of WISC is we're going to design and build our airplane this year. We're going to fly it. We're going to certify it. And we're going to start to deliver the first autonomous passenger service to passengers.
And then you're going to scale. That's what's going to happen.
Yes, I agree.
Brian, as we look to wrap up this insightful conversation for today, what would you like our listeners to take away with them?
Well, I think, you know, boy, I don't know if I have a pithy thing to say other than, you know, it's a real journey to do this kind of a work. This is, you know, this is not something that happens in, you know, a day. This is something that will happen certainly now, but over time. And so, you know, the key thing for us is we're not driven by schedule pressure. We're driven by doing the right work in the right way and, you know, only flying and delivering this kind of a service to the public when we're ready. And we think we have a viewpoint on how we can do that this decade. And we're really excited to be on that mission.
WISC is doing it the right way. Today is tomorrow. Tomorrow is today. The future is WISC. Brian, thank you so much for coming on SAE Tomorrow Today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to SAE Tomorrow Today. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, please kindly rate, review, and let us know what topics you'd like for us to explore next. Be sure to join us next week when we discuss artificial intelligence and how it is redefining the aerospace industry.
SAE International makes no representations as to the accuracy of the information presented in this podcast. The information and opinions are for general information only. SAE International does not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast.